slide, as the honourable members are aware of many of the issues in them. As you know, our legislative mandate at GPW is contained in the establishment of GPW in 2009 by the Minister of Finance, Home Affairs and Public Service Administration as a government component. And as a government component, GPW delivers security printing services to government. The honourable members know that our vision is to be the state's mandated security printer, and in many ways we think we've achieved that already, though it still has to be enshrined in legislation, which hopefully will occur within the next few years. Our mission is to provide cost-effective, reliable, and timely services in security printing to all spheres of government, to provide the public with valuable information, and to disseminate government information through technology, innovation, and service excellence. And you can see our values of reliability, integrity, accuracy, and stakeholder satisfaction. In terms of our current situation, the transformation of GPW into a government component has been completed after the process started in 2009. Over that period, our revenue has doubled and now exceeds 1 billion rand a year. We've had 6 unqualified audits, and for the first time ever, we've received a clean audit from the Auditor General for 2014-2015. We believe we've achieved our vision of being the security printer of choice for government, though as I say, that still has to be enshrined in legislation. Hopefully we will complete that transformation journey through the promulgation of the State Printers Bill, hopefully by 2017. And we believe that we've consolidated our position as a government-owned entity running on sound business principles, in an environment where many state-owned companies struggle to maintain their balance sheet. We've been profitable over that entire six-year period, and all those profits are plowed back into the purchase of new equipment and renovation of the Visaki Street premises. And the GPW fully supports the objectives set out in the National Development Plan, and specifically Chapter 13 on building a capable and developmental state. Through clear government structures and stable leadership, this government component is committed to achieving its developmental potential. The GPW's financial viability is dependent on its ability to generate revenue from services rendered, particularly to our mother department, the Department of Home Affairs. Although GPW can report on increased outputs, service delivery is still negatively affected by human and material resource constraints. The lack of experienced and qualified senior managers, artisans, and administrative personnel impacts on service delivery, resulting in GPW being compelled to outsource certain functions. The honourable members are aware of our 3 strategic outcome-oriented goals, the first being to further develop the government components to become a state-owned company. The second being to optimize processes and facilities to increase operational effectiveness and improve customer service. And the third being to have an efficient, effective, well-trained and developed workforce and a special remuneration dispensation for the government component. In the latter respect, we failed to persuade DPSA of that imperative. In terms of our key projects during the 2014-2015 financial year, we managed to print 1,660,280 smart ID cards during that period. In the period before 13-14, we printed 125,112. So the total up until March 31st, 2015 was 1,763,499. The total as we speak now is approximately 2.5 million. And we are printing up to 200,000 smart ID cards per month. However, we have procured a 4th smart ID card personalization machine. And each of the 4 machines are able to produce 1,000 cards per hour. So on 1 8-hour shift a day, it means that GPW is capable of producing 8 million smart ID cards per annum. So in terms of Home Affairs' ambition, of replacing all 38 million ID books with smart ID cards within the next 5 years, our operational capacity can easily meet that target simply with 1 8-hour shift a day. In terms of business transformation, we find that ICT is increasingly being used at GPW for both internal and external services and products. We're also past the midway point in the 600 million rand asset recapitalization program, replacing all our machines. And we've commenced with the design and development for Pavilion 3, which will be an examination printing section, as well as a dispatch center for passports and smart ID cards, which should be completed by early 2017. We're continuing to migrate GPW employees to the new GPW establishment, and we've made proactive efforts on human resource development, achieving in the period under review 2,327 training days, mainly focusing on employee health, safety, and personal finance, with a special focus on diversity. This next diagram is a diagram of the new examination printing and dispatch center that is being constructed for completion by early 2017. And to the right of the slide is Khosi Mampuru Street, and to the left of the slide is Isahi Street. And it will mean that the entire process of ID and passport production will be virtually completely automated from the time a citizen walks into a DHA office or a bank and has their details captured by Live Capture and verified on the HANIF database. The data will be downloaded to GPW. The servers will download packages of data to the four machines and also to passport machines as well. The machines will produce passports or IDs, which will then be delivered by chute from passport factory across to the dispatch center, put into pigeonholes according to the Department of Home Affairs offices, and then given to the courier to be dispatched back to Home Affairs office with a turnaround within of less than 48 hours for both passports and IDs. So that dispatch center will be complete by early 2017. This slide here shows part of the renovation of the Visakha Street campus. This building is on the edge of Minar Street to the south of the Visakha Street campus, and shows a building with parking and a paper store and various other facilities. And the next slide is an aerial representation. Now, to the left, you can see the new building on Minar Street. To the far right upper corner is the current passport and smart ID card factory. And adjacent to it is the Pavilion 2, which is the high security printing division. And then at the top of the slide is the dispatch center and high-speed examination printing center. And then at the bottom of the slide are the paper warehouses, paper stores, etc. So this entire renovation should be complete by the end of 2019 at a cost of in excess of 1.2 billion rand. And as the honorable members know, this 11-year process has been slow, partly because of challenges at Department of Public Works. We continue to be productive, as the slide shows, producing 742,000 passports, 922,000 ID books, and as you know, those are diminishing now as the smart ID card takes over, the 1.66 million smart ID cards, examination books, government gazettes, etc. Fewer government gazettes are being printed since the launch of the Electronic Gazette in 2012. I'll hand over now to my CFO to go through the financial statements.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. Yeah, I'll just run quickly through this. As far as the income is concerned, the CEO has already mentioned that for the first time in the history, GPW's turnover is exceeded 1 billion rand mark. I think over the past financial year we again maintained our profitability. We are really sweating our assets, and that's why we are seeing the kind of returns that we're seeing. if you look at the balance sheet specifically, although we are investing continuously, like Professor alluded to, the fourth ID card machine, our cash in bank remains steady. So all this money is actually already earmarked for the development of the smart district. Our debtor days, we are intervening there on a daily basis. It depends on the client, on the type of product and so on. And we do have regular meetings with the various departments, including Home Affairs. And on this slide 21, you can specifically see the investments that we've made as far as property, plant and equipment is concerned compared to the previous financial year. I don't know. I think I can conclude there. I don't know what you want to...
In terms of human resource, GPW has undergone great transformation in its business processes, technology, products and services over the past 120 years, but has also undergone dramatic demographic transformation in its workforce of 538, from an organization that before 1994 was 100% white and predominantly male, to the organization that you can see on the table below, where 46% of our staff are female, 65% are black African, 28% white, 5% colored, and 2% Indian. In terms of performance, we've simplified our performance information so that we currently now have 45 targets within the 38 key performance areas. So that's 45 targets among 38 key performance areas. And we managed to achieve or exceed 40 of those 45 targets. So that's, in terms of performance, that's a success rate of 89%. I shan't go in detail through each of the 38 key performance indicators, but the ones that you should particularly note are the equipment replacement ratio, which is KPI number one. And as I said, the 600 million rand program of asset replacement should be complete by 2019 and will mean that in the newly renovated Visaka Street premises, virtually all of the machines will have been replaced with new machines within the previous 6 years, which will make GPW one of the most advanced security printers in the world in terms of its facilities and its machines. We have continued to maintain high standards in KPI number two in terms of the production of smart ID cards and ensuring that 97% are conformed to client specifications, but that 100% are delivered perfect to the clients. In terms of ID books, a dwindling number now. We used to produce about 2.2 million ID books a year. In the last financial year, it was 920,000. I imagine in the next few years, it will reduce to zero as the ID cards take over. And our turnaround time at the bottom of the slide in terms of identity documents and cards is of the order of 3.0 days. On the next slide, we continue to maintain a very low spoilage rate by international standards of about 1.2%. But again, the passports are delivered to the clients are perfect. There's no room for error there. And again, with examination scripts, we aim for 100% quality in terms of time frame and quality of the product, and standard operating procedures, etc. On the next slide, again, when it comes to theft or loss of passports or IDs or exam papers, our target is to maintain a zero loss indicator, which we achieved for the last financial period. And we continue to develop and implement the Electronic Gazette system. And in March this year, we launched a facility whereby submissions to the Gazette are made on electronic PDF files. And the papers, the system is becoming increasingly paperless and reducing the amount of paper that's used in printing paper gazettes. On the next slide, in terms of ICT services, Again, we managed to maintain high standards in terms of 99.8% system availability, no security breaches, downtime of less than 60 minutes on incidents, 3.5 hours to on average respond to calls, etc., etc. And then on the following slide, in terms of marketing and stakeholder relations, it's been a challenge for the GPW in terms of trying to secure security printing work on the African continent. And I think I explained to the honourable members why that might be, but we continue to attempt this, and we'll probably lose our channels at the African Union where we print the passport in order to try and get security printing work in other African countries. But nevertheless, there are many new products that are launching, and the latest new product will be the driver's license, which Department of Transport has asked us to begin production of in 2016. The Department of Transport has issued a tender for the back office systems, for the IT systems, etc., etc. But GPW will actually be printing the 9 to 12 million driver's licenses the Department of Transport requires over the coming 3 years. The passport will be a polycarbonate passport. The driver's license will be a polycarbonate, but will have no chip in it, though there will be a facility for Mark II version if people wish to have a driver's license with a chip that they can use for driving overseas, etc. So that will be the latest of our new products coming in the coming in this financial year. On the next page, as we mentioned, for the first time after 6 unqualified audits, we managed to obtain a clean audit. And, of course, the challenge will be to maintain that clean audit in this financial year and subsequent years. And as you can see, in terms of KPI 22, there's been a dramatic reduction in our audit findings, a 55% reduction in audit findings. And we've remained profitable. Debt collection times have come down to 71 days. On the next slide, in the KPIs 27 to 32, you can see that the various indicators are healthy, though we struggle to maintain a rand value of procurement from broad-based black economic enterprises. And we have our asset recapitalization program, which means heavy investments in new machines and in renovation facilities. Maintaining a high rate of return on capital investment. And as I say, one of the challenges is completing the construction and renovation of the Sahi Street. But Pavilion 3 is progressing well. The tender has been issued, and the contractor started work and should finish the work by the end of 2016. In terms of human resources, I mentioned about the challenges of recruiting and retaining skilled staff, particularly as we transform from a traditional print company into a print and media company that uses ICT both in terms of its internal processes, for instance, the enterprise resource planning system, managed information systems, in terms of the machines that we use. These new machines are heavily ICT-based, but also in terms of our products and services, for example, the Electronic Gazette, which rides on an internet-based platform. And so training and development and skill development are a critical part of that transformation from a print company into a print and media company. And so those are the 38 KPIs. And on the slide number 35, you can see a summary of our performance, where in operations production, 9 of the 11 targets were achieved. In strategic management, all 13 were achieved. In finance, 12 of the 14 targets were achieved. In human resources, 6 of the 7 targets were achieved. So in all, of the 45 targets in those 38 KPIs, we managed to achieve 40 of them, which is a success rate of 89%. Thank you for your attention.
So thank you very much, Prof. And clean, straightforward, short or court, and wonderful.
Do you have anything that you want to raise with GPW, Honorable Madsen?
Yes.
Yes, you can proceed.
Yes, is I agree, Chair. It's clean, short, and to the point. But it does not mean that you are not going to engage with the CEO. Thanks very much. Let me just formally congratulate you for obtaining a clean audit. I think you deserve a round of applause on that one, because that's what, as a committee, we are looking for, in fact, in all departments of government. But let me just get a clarity here. Since you introduced the e-gazette since 2012, but it seems that there's no sharp decline in printing of pages. Maybe just share with us what is the reason why. And the second question is that since there's a state bill that is on a pipeline, so which means that you are going to have a state-owned company. If you go to your slides whereby you talk about the challenges in terms of human resource, you mentioned that one of the challenges is that you don't attract, it seems that you don't attract people with ICT skills. So now my question is that as we are moving to have a state-owned company, of which I agree, I support fully, because I believe that one, maybe it will yield results in terms of employment. That is my own thinking, I'm not sure. So now, if you have those challenges in terms of human resource, where you have, sometimes you have advertised posts, whereby you have to put them on hold. So my question is that, are you ready for a state-owned company? And then the last one, can you share some experience with other African countries if we do have promotion in terms of the GPW in the continent? Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hussein.
Chair, thank you very much. I just have one question, and it's related to the government-owned entity. And I remember, Prof, that you, the reasons you advanced was the inability to retain highly skilled staff, and that we were losing them to the private sector because of the low salaries. But when I look at the turnover here, it shows like 3% or something. So I'm not seeing the evidence to justify the claim that you were making. And then you also say the other reason you advanced today was that you're having to outsource a lot of the work. I'm also not seeing in your report that an enormous amount of money that you're spending on consultant fees. So the two reasons you advanced for converting to a government-owned entity is not supported by the information in your annual report. Can you come up with another two reasons, then?
Honorable Fiedler.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. In the report on targets for the strategic management branch, it is indicated that in the report on targets, there was one ICT security breach and 1 hour of impact on a major accident. What are the nature of these breaches and how are they addressed? Thank you, sir.
Honorable Kane.
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you for the comprehensive report. Brief to the point. But I think my questions have been asked, but I would just ask maybe to qualify why I'm asking it for the second time. Yes, also we are also commending you on the clean audit. Just keep it up, never go back to unqualified. Because the 6 unqualified didn't mean that you are clean. So now that you have got this clean audit, just brush it up so that you keep it now, another 6 clean audit. Now I'm also concerned about the fact that you have used those some vacant and advertised management positions that are put on hold when you say in the special analysis you have got lack of experience and qualified senior managers, artisans and administrative personnel. Now that impacts on service delivery. Now that we are putting the advertisements on hold, and then now you even said that now you are compelled to outsource. Why do you really go that route of outsourcing? Because of withholding those positions. Really, I have a concern on that. Secondly, on page 33, you're talking about human resources. And I understand that you said that you didn't get the target also, according to the minus I see there. But at the same time, it goes back to this question of stalling the process of advertising. Is it because you are going to form this state-owned you are going now to be state-owned? Is that now you decided not to advertise? And thirdly, maybe also I'll touch on what Honorable Martinez has touched. What intention are you having to help in Africa? Noting that the Home Affairs has said that they've got 11 centers there, which I'm also, for example, worried that do you think that if you can have them there, you can have also the monitoring processes so that you can monitor those so that there's no manipulation? Because I'm worried by Home Affairs, but I thought that I'd ask that question because it just leaked to me that as much as they say that there are 11 state centers there, and so there are 11 centers there in those in India, China, and Nigeria. I was also concerned really about Nigeria, if you are really what is going to happen when you see that there will be manipulation and corruption due to the issue of these refugees versus asylum seekers. Sometimes people make themselves as asylum seekers though they want to be, they are refugees. So, and that's what to check. If you can do that, help them in those African countries, can you also be able to monitor that process abroad? Thank you. No, I'm sorry, in African countries. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think I just want to pick up on one issue. Your vision, I think, is to be a state-mandated security print. I'm picking up on security print. Then on slide 9, you speak about being compelled to outsource certain functions. Can you integrate the two in relation to security and an element of risk? Then the second question is how many or what sort of percentage of your personnel is disabled persons? Disabled persons. And then the other issue is just simply to try and confirm whether it is possible that on the information of smart ID cards, when it comes from Home Affairs and lands into your territory, is it possible that there can be manipulation to alter the information and produce a different ID card than the one that came from Home Affairs in the area of your operations? Yeah, I think those are the only ones from my side. And if you are ready, you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. I think in terms of the Electronic Gazette and the lack of reduction in the amount of paper used, I should perhaps ask the CFO to answer that because he's the project leader on the Electronic Gazette.
Thank you, Chair. I think as far as the Gazette is concerned, we introduced the output side in 2012, in July 2012. The input side we introduced now and went live in March this year. Now, there's a difference between published and printed. So we're trying to print less and less, and that's why the Gazette is freely available online. So it's published online, but it's not necessary that you print all those pages. So if you look at the previous financial year, if you received all the gazettes, you would have received, an individual would have received it roughly about 109,000 pages, A4 pages. And that's what we're trying to reduce. We don't keep stock of that anymore. And in fact, we're in talks with Treasury in order to get, you know, that we pay a nominal value of 5 rand per gazette. The reason for that is so that people don't just come with their buckets on the Friday and pick up all the gazettes and go and sell it as recycled paper, because they can make some money through that. So we are in talks with National Treasury in order to see if people still insist on a printed version to have it on a cost recovery basis. So it won't be 5 rand anymore. So different gazettes will have obviously different prices because of the number of pages. And I think that's as far as the gazette's concerned.
In terms of the state-owned company and the HR challenges, one of the main purposes of wanting to become a state-owned company is because that has been the intention of government for the last 15 years. In 2009, when GBW became a government component, the primary reason for that was that the National Treasury and DPSA at the time felt that the GPW's affairs were not were in a state that would allow a state transition to a state-owned company immediately. And so they recommended the temporary state of a government component for a period of 5 years or more. The minister felt that now, in 2015, is the time to complete that transition, and has therefore begun the process of consulting with other government departments, developing a business case, etc., and will obviously be bringing the state printers bill to the portfolio committee as well in order to see if this can be promulgated before the end of next year. Now, in terms of the HR challenges, we feel that conversion to a state-owned company would assist with those HR challenges, and I'll explain what I mean by that. One of the reasons why the Portfolio Committee some years ago recommended a special salary dispensation for GBW was to deal with the problems of recruitment and retention of skilled staff, including ICT skills. DTSA rejected that application. And so our feeling was that rather than continuing to lobby for a special salary dispensation, we should rather complete the transformation of state-owned company, because as a state-owned company, we would not be under the Public Service Act anymore, and we would be able to set market-related salaries, which would mean that the skilled professional staff, ICT staff, and artisans that we need for our new business processes and for our new machines would be more easily recruited and retained if we were able to pay market-related salaries. So we believe that from 2017 onwards, our competence in terms of recruitment and retention of skilled staff will be dramatically improved. Are we ready to become a state-owned company? The minister certainly thinks so, and we believe we are. And testament to that is 6 years of profitable operations, unqualified audits culminating in a clean audit now, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of the Honorable Maxwell was referring to our ambitions to become a security printer to other African governments, we have had some success in that respect for a while. For example, we did produce the Mozambique driver's license. We still currently produce the African Union passport. But our chief director for market and stakeholder relations is continuing to attempt to break into the African market. And we are being assisted in this by Home Affairs, so that, for example, the deputy minister invited GBW to come and exhibit at the Civil Registration and Vital Statistics African conference that was held in Cote d'Ivoire at the beginning of last year, I think it was. And so we did, when we presented, and as I mentioned to the honorable members before, ministers, deputy ministers, and directors general from African countries were impressed by the technology that GBW had, but still expressed reservations about parting with the current suppliers of their passports, security documents, etc., who are mainly in Europe and whatever, often the former colonial powers of those particular countries. So it's a challenge, but we are working to meet that challenge together with assistance from Department of Home Affairs. Yes, our turnover rate is low at 3%, but terms of recruitment retention, it's not so much in the entire 538 workforce where turnover is low that we're concerned. It's more in the highly skilled staff where we struggle to recruit. Positions often remain vacant. And once we do recruit and train such highly skilled staff, they're often poached by other organizations such as UNISA Press, South African Banknote Company, and even the private sector. But as I say, we believe that conversion to state-owned company, being able to pay market-related salaries, will assist in recruitment and retention. In terms of the paucity of consultants and outsourcing, I should perhaps ask the CFO to comment on that.
Thank you, Chair. There are basically three types of businesses within the GPW. There's the security portion, there's the product security, and then there's let's call it the general printing and other materials. As far as outsourcing is concerned, it's not outsourcing to consultants, it's outsourcing to various printing houses. But what we mainly outsource is general printing. So what we're trying to do is be a one-stop shop for government. Obviously, if we want to be, in our vision, the state-mandated security printing printer, the asset replacement program is focused on security printing. So we're not focused, don't want to be a competitor for CTP or Rapal or any of those companies. So that is your big other places. We don't specialize in that. And so in other words, we outsource general printing, but we don't outsource high security products like, for example, IDs and passports. And coming back to your question about whether it's possible to you set up different systems, and I think that comes back to the whole issue about the skills. If data is downloaded from Home Affairs in the production of an ID card, for example, in the production of the ID card, when it goes through the various processes, there's various messages, electronic messages, between the GPW and Home Affairs. And that's how the system has been set up. So anybody, if it so should happen, that somebody could, let's say, if I may use the word hack, that system, and there is one message that doesn't go through, that passport or ID or whatever will not be valid. So it will never be able to activate that passport. So in order to introduce that or intercept the line, I think it's virtually impossible because you need to replicate the different algorithms and all those kind of things in those various messages. And like I said, when it goes through the various stages of production, there's messages between Home Affairs and GPW, and that's a single line. That's not even linked to our corporate environment. There's two separate environments. There's the security printing side, which includes passports and IDs, and then there's a corporate environment where all our other ID systems run. So it's just a direct line between Home Affairs and the government printing. So just to conclude, we outsource general printing security, and there's a small portion of product security, like for example a vehicle driver's license, but that, if we do outsource that, we do that under supervision. So there's somebody from a GPW, from a security perspective, that sees that all processes are followed. We hand over obviously the artwork, the plates are made, the work is printed, and then once it's done, then all the things are given back to the officials that's overseeing that whole process. Thanks. Sorry, Jay, there's one question about the security breach, and I plead guilty for that one. You'll see in our presentation we said none. There was no security breach. I don't know, somewhere something happened, and in the annual report, instead of none, it says one. But there was no security breach. I apologize for that.
The Honourable Member mentioned about the vacant posts and how does that impact upon service delivery. Fortunately, as a manufacturing outfit, it hasn't really impacted on service delivery, but it has meant that we've had to outsource for two reasons. One is in terms of the skill sets of the people in our organization able to deliver on a particular contract or project, and the second has been in terms of the machines that are able to carry out a certain job. So in terms of the latter,
there's less and less outsourcing because we're now acquiring more and more machines that are able to do those particular types of jobs. An example I give you would be the old-fashioned machines were machines that took 5 hours to set up, then they would do a run, and then they took another 5 hours to clean, etc. Modern digital printers, for example, are more efficient in that in terms of the fact that if it's a job that's just 200 copies of an annual report or whatever, to stop a machine and take 24 hours in order to produce 200 annual reports is obviously ridiculous. However, with modern digital printers, etc., there is no make-ready time, there isn't changeover time, and so to do a small job in-house is much more cost-effective. So those examples of why there is less and less outsourcing now. No, we are not stalling the advertising of vacant posts while we wait for the state-owned company to appear. But we do know that we will struggle to fill some of those vacant posts, such as the post for an activity-based costing consultant, activity-based costing expert. We will struggle to fill those sort of posts until we become a state-owned company and are able to pay market-related salaries. In terms of looking for security printing business in Africa, we don't envisage that the security concerns will be a major risk in that we only print in one facility, and that's in Pretoria. And so work would be downloaded from a particular state printer in another African country in order for us to produce here. Obviously, in terms of the data that's captured in that particular country, well, we cannot necessarily vouch for that, but we would be able to vouch for the quality of the security printed documents that we would produce in Pretoria. The Honorable Chairperson mentioned about the vision of becoming a security printer. You know, we feel that one of the main tenets of the State Printers Bill, as you'll see when the Minister presents it as a portfolio committee, is that government is asked to state that all government security printing should be done by government printing works for reasons of security, for reasons of cost control, etc., etc. And so we would then be the mandated security printer for government in terms of legislation. It would also ensure that a certain loophole that exists would be closed, in that the bill sees a council for security printing being established by government, whereby they would accredit security printers in the private sector and, of course, GPW, and they would ensure that certain types of documents, by law, could not be produced by another agency. For example, there's no law that stops anybody from producing a passport or ID book at the moment, but when the bill goes through, there will be control over such loopholes. In terms of outsourcing, yes, outsourcing is only a security risk, and that's one reason why we look forward to the State Printers Bill being promulgated to ensure that as far as government security printing is concerned, almost all of it is done by GPW, except for certain exemptions such as, for example, Department of Defense military maps. We have no ambition to print military maps for Department of Defense. Or state securities printing. State security has an in-house printer, obviously, and we would not wish to do that work for them. In terms of the percent who are disabled, 11 of our 538 employees are disabled, which, if my math is correct, is 2%. So it does not meet our target, but obviously there are challenges in that respect in terms of being a manufacturing concern, etc. And then lastly, in terms of the chairperson asked about, is there room for manipulation of data when it arrives from Home Affairs to the servers at GPW? We are always aware that when it comes to cybersecurity, one is never 100% safe, and one must always be one step ahead of the criminal syndicates who will try and use an IT system to insert a false identity into that data stream between Home Affairs and GPW. Currently, it has not happened, and we have all sorts of mechanisms of
preventing that, and as the CFO has mentioned, the ICT systems involved in passports and ID production are totally separate from the IT systems in the rest of the company. But, you know, we will continue to work with cybersecurity, home affairs, and with state security, etc., to ensure that we always remain one step ahead of the international syndicates in terms of avoiding identity fraud. I hope I've answered the questions, Chairperson.
Yeah, well, you have done more than enough. Unless if Honorable Maxson, before she fights me, then she's satisfied. You are done.
I'm fine.
Honorable members, are you done, all of you? Okay. Thanks very much. And of course, that it has been a straightforward report that we are used to. And it looks like we are going to be used to this report, I'm sure, for the next 2, 3, 4 years. And the body will just make that mistake of calling you, because that is what we are paid for, to call you. And then we speak to this. And but thanks for the report that you have presented, and also the achievements that you have made, as you have already been previously praised for the clean audit that you have received. And we hope that all those other sections that you did not achieve, you will continue to strive to achieve on them, and ensure that you sustain the clean audit. And but the clean audit should be felt by your customers. It should not be on the paper only. It must be felt by the customers on the ground, and so that then they can attest that you are clean. Thank you very much. And
thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Yes. And then can we have within about 3 minutes and have the IEC to be established? Thanks. But I also want to indicate that the report that we're going to be receiving today is a report that relates to the period when we ran the 2014 national and provincial elections. It is clear that when we run the elections, in a complex environment, and therefore there could be certain things that we slip on, largely because on the day of the elections we've got 218,000 staff members who are stationed in our organizations in various areas. The report that we are presenting to you, nevertheless, it's a report that indicates that we did not get a qualification. There are quite a number of issues that the Auditor General has raised. We have started addressing some of those issues, and those that we have not started, we will be developing a program of action to try to deal with those issues so that finally they are dealt with. So I'm going to request our CEO, Mr. Mwetya, to make a presentation. And as we agreed earlier on, we're not going to be dealing with the vision, the values, the strategic direction, because those issues, we understand them. We just deal with the issues. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you must know that the time that you will take will have a bearing on when you're going to leave this committee room. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon to honorable members. I am very grateful that I do not have to do quite a lot. Mbonisi will go to slide number 14. The organogram, the other things have not changed, the mandates have not changed. Slide number 14 is a summary of the performance information, the one after that one, Mbonisi, that's the one. That summary provides a summary of our performance for the year. We have three strategic-oriented goals. The first one relates to strengthening governance. Stay on that slide. Strengthening governance, institutional excellence, professionalism, and enabling business processes at all levels of the organization. The second one relates to achieving preeminence in the area of managing elections and referenda, including the strengthening of a cooperative relationship with political parties. And the third one is strengthening electoral democracy in our nation and beyond our borders where we are required. If we look at that summary, we have all in all 36 targets that we have developed. We have attained 28 of the 36, and that gives us 78% achievement. But how did we do? In goal one, we have 14 of those indicators, and out of the 14, we have exceeded targets for 4 and attained 8. We failed on 2 targets. In the second strategic outcome-oriented goal, we have 13 performance indicators. We have exceeded 5. We have achieved another 5, and we have failed on 3. In the third strategic outcome-oriented goal, we have 9 performance indicators. We have 6 of those that we exceeded. We did not achieve on 3. I think it is important to point out that particularly in the third strategic oriented goal area, we developed quite late into the year a number of checks and balances that we needed to build. And you will recall, members will recall, that when we came here the year before, this was an area where we did the poorest. And we did not have a system that would verify and would provide us with the ability to have auditable information. And this is an area where we say we have done expand voter education in this community, but how do we verify we have done that, and how do we present that information in an auditable way to the Auditor General? We have since implemented a system, and it was implemented after this reporting period had started. We will have the first fully reported period next year, and we are confident that this is an area of improvement that we will see when we go forward. Chairperson, the rest of the slides following from 17 to 21 really deal with the details of what we have achieved, what we exceeded, and what we did not attain. Perhaps it's important that I indicate that in the area where we have felt very strongly that we needed to improve more, it's the area in the first goal, and we have implemented. But in the two other areas where we haven't, this indeed relates to matters of engaging with our stakeholders in the period relating to the elections. And those are not areas that, are too ghastly, but these are areas that we need to ensure that in the planning phase, we synchronize the planned dates for elections with this. For example, if you look at the governance committees, it's one of the areas we did not achieve. It's because at the time of elections, although the commission met a lot more to deal with issues of objections, oversight, and so on and so forth, they did not specifically meet in the governance committee. So those are the things we are really talking about. Chairperson, if there are no issues for me to deal with, and we will take questions in the details of the achievement, I'd like to speak to the financial statements and ask our CFO to deal with them very briefly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of the Committee. I'll give a brief overview of the financial outcomes for the year ended 31st March 2015. The basis of preparation for the annual financial statements remains unchanged, and the audit outcome in respect to the financial statements was unqualified, with no emphasis of matter paragraphs and no additional matter paragraphs. In relation to the other regulatory and legal requirements, there were no findings on the usefulness of predetermined objective information and one finding on the reliability in relation to the outreach goal, as indicated by the CEO. Much work has been done in this area, but there is still a little ways to go with the implementation of the new system. There were other items listed in the Auditor General's report. The quarterly reports in terms of the new Treasury instruction were not completed. There was a misstatement that was corrected. We did incur irregular expenditure, and it is noted that there is an item there that is under or will be under discussion with the AG in relation to the irregular expenditure. And there was a single instance that the AG identified where a staff member had an interest in a contract, which we are following up at the moment, although the matter is slightly complicated in that by the time it was identified, that staff member had already left the service of the Electoral Commission. In terms of the financial outcomes, our revenue, which is mainly the vote from Treasury, was 1.5 billion, and our total expenditure for the period was 1.6 billion. You will notice that year on year things are relatively stable. Key movements are, in terms of goods and services, you will note increase from 740 million to 950 million. In fact, this relates to, in the main, the fact that in the prior year, which was a two registration weekend year, we spent 75 million on the 50,000 odd staff that we employ for every registration weekend, whereas, as indicated by the Vice Chair, the year ended 31st of March was an election year, and the 218,000 people that we employ on election day cost something like 244 million, and because it's a subsistence and travel allowance, it's reflected in goods and services. That accounts for the 200 million increase there. And then in relation to repairs and maintenance, the committee will note that spend has gone down from 31.7 million to 23.2. The bulk of this relates to the fact that in the prior year, immediately preceding the elections, we refurbished our stock of Zip-Zips, replacing the internal and external battery packs in order to get them election ready. Therefore, the spend in 14 was artificially inflated by that periodic non-routine spend. In relation to the statement of financial position, looking at the asset base first, broadly speaking, it's relatively stable. The committee will note that inventories at the 31st of March 14 were at 43 million. That obviously is a period sort of 6 weeks or so before the election, and that stock was obviously used on election day, bringing more stable, our base inventory level is around the 8 million mark in a flat non-election period. The rest of the numbers are relatively straightforward, and obviously after elections we start to consider replenishment, refurbishment, and administrative tasks. Therefore, the non-current assets held for sale has gone up as we embarked upon a process of reviewing our asset base to identify obsolete and redundant items. Then in terms of the liabilities, trade and other payables has gone down year on year. Again, the election being in the early part of 14 meant it was a heightened activity period at that point, whereas 72 million is a more normalized level. And broadly speaking, that's the only significant movement in relation to those. Thank you, Chair.
Are you done? Okay. Okay. I think in the past elections, there has been a public outcry that there were certain temporary staff that were claiming that you have not paid them. And of course, it has not been easy for one to hear IEC responses to that. But they have kept on coming into SAFM and then raising this particular matter. Some claiming that not, even today have not been paid, and months after the elections has happened. And then the other issue is in relation to the office. Remember that you had to do something in terms of the contract or the tender. You had to go back to the court and actually normalize the terms or whatever, that you need to rework on them. And then what has happened? That happened. Is everything now okay in terms of the office space? There is no risk that you can be kicked out at any time. What is the situation? Honorable members, the IEC in front of you. Honorable Hussein.
Chair, I just want to raise one matter in particular, and it talks to the issue of voter registration. I was encouraged to hear the comments on voter education. Although I think that the IEC places far too much of emphasis on teaching people how to vote, but not how to contribute towards free and fair elections. I know you and I had this conversation previously, and it's an area that the IEC doesn't want to delve into, but I'm sure it can be done within the context of promoting free and fair elections, and not just how to vote. So the issue for me is this thing about voter registration. And if you look at the latest population statistics, if I'm not mistaken, there must be about 36 odd million people who are qualified to be registered. Unless I'm wrong, you might have more updated figures than I do. But there's 25 million on the voter roll, according to that report which you have here, page 24, is it? So, I mean, clearly, the IEC, you can see that there are still millions of South Africans that are not registered to vote. And I get the point that I think that you made once before, where people have a right to choose not to vote if they don't want to. But I'm not sure that that actually contributes to functional democracy. I mean, the ideal for me would be to make sure that we're in the region of 90% odd, where people who do qualify, or can qualify in terms of the age, are actually registered. I know that you do the outreach programs closer to the election, but I'm convinced that the IEC can do much more than that. I had a Home Affairs earlier, and how they've come up with innovative ideas of rolling out smart IDs to the banks. Why can't the IEC do those things? Surely there must be more ways in which you could have regular voter registration and encourage more people to come out to register. And on the topic of outreach, even including in by-elections, I don't get the sense that the IEC actually is more proactive in ensuring that there's a higher turnout in by-elections. In some cases they are, but I think that is one of the factors is because of high political activity rather than the IEC's role in the turnout. I mean, in many instances, many people don't even know that there is an election happening in when it comes to by-election, unless, of course, they're informed by the political parties. And I agree that I think that when it comes to voter turnout, it's very much a participation or what's the word? That there is a joint operation between political parties and the IEC. I get that. But it can't only be the political parties, and there must be more ways in which you can do more things that you can do to encourage people to come out. A simple poster, I'm not sure that actually does the trick. So the question I have is that are you considering some sort of innovative ideas to achieve those two things, or is it going to be business as usual in the years to come? Thank you.
Honorable Ken.
Thank you, Sir President. Thank you for the presentation. My first question will be on the issue of the Lisa Committee, which I understand, I remember it was on the High Court in 2014, about now I'm concerned about the irregular expenditure of that Riverside Office Park. What is the position now? What is the position now? And how is the case? Are there any disciplinary measures which have been taken on that regard? And also, do you have any alternate office you intend to lease? Another place you intend to lease? Secondly, on the report on the Auditor General report, page 16, that talks to the driver of internal controls. Now, noting that there's a concern in a very critical issue, because you know that IEC is a very critical component. Now, when you look at those, you see that there are concerns on the proper record keeping, risk management, IT systems, and HR management. Now, what is your mechanism in place to see that all those are being taken care of? Because really, those are critical areas according to this report of the AG. And they said that it's a concern. So what I'm intending to do, what are your measures in place to rectify? Thank you, sir.
Last
question, I forgot. On page 25, there's a bullet that talks to a misstatement was corrected. Which statement is that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to take this opportunity to welcome Commissioner Mashini. And because I know all of them who are here in front of me, it's my first time to meet Commissioner Mashini. I just want to make a follow-up on what has been raised by Honorable the previous member that just spoke now, Kenya. Mm. I would like to hear from you, IEC, because out of those 14 that was raised by the AG report, the key control of portfolios, as she put it very correctly, that those are the critical issues. Maybe if you can hear from you, what are you suggesting moving forward? Because it's looked bad. Out of 14, 6 are of concern. And if you look at your presentation on HR management,
or HR on HR matters. You were not deep. You were just a passing in terms of speaking about the HR issues there. I thought you were going to maybe to get some clarity, maybe even challenges that why are you facing this challenge under HR management. I'm not saying the other important issues that was raised by AG is not important, but I just want to get your input regarding the AG's report with a lighter note. I think, Chair, you have touched on the Riverside Office Park issue as well as Honorable Kenya as well. My question will be, let's say the court is setting aside the lease agreement, so do you have a plan B to have IC headquarters? Or you'll be shocked after this pronouncement by the court? I'm not saying the court will be pronouncing against you or something. I'm just checking if we have plan B in place. Pension lump sum payment, I think that's where the AG was also stressing that, and I see that you have a disagreement with him, or with his office rather. So I would like to get your view on that one. What can you tell us as a committee? Honorable Hussein spoke about the voter registration. I would also like to raise that concern as well. Maybe just to get in a broader view, what is the IEC doing in terms of the campaigns? Because we are approaching the local government elections now, and you know there has been a lower turnout even on national elections, but is more when it comes to local government elections. People are not interested. I think we spoke about this before when we came into the committee, and it was a cause for concern that the IEC must do something, because people, they seem that they are very disinterested. So I would like to know, maybe do you have campaigns that have been put in place in order to go and talk to people on the ground to make them to see the need to go and vote for their local councillors? Because I think it can be a cause for concern for IEC now. After we voted, there are so many protests, especially against councillors. So it means that those councillors are not popular to the people. I think you must join hands as IEC. I know that you've got nothing to do in terms of choosing councillors. Those are the thing of political parties. But I think we must join hands in order to avoid a situation whereby we find ourselves after elections took place. Yes, for now, let me just pause there. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hussein.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I omitted just one question, please. Also around the voter registration issue, the IEC is very aware of the increasing number of complaints around fraudulent vote registrations, and the matter is being drawn out in court and all of that. And this is becoming an ongoing problem, especially around by-elections. And I wonder whether there's anything that you're planning from your side to try and put a stop to this thing. And you can't shift the onus on to the voter in terms of the current system and say, if you want to object, then go and bring us the evidence. And surely there must be other ways in which you will be able to ask the voters to show proof of residence. For example, if you open a bank account, you have to produce proof. So is there something that you're looking at in terms of cleaning up the voters' role and reducing the risk of fraudulent voter registration? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. I just think that at one time when we had an engagement with yourself, I'm sure it's during the budget, there was an indication that the zip machines were actually becoming outdated. They were at the end of their waking life or shelf life, whatever it can be called. And we made noise about that when you go to the next elections next year, then we should be really convinced that you'll be having working machines that will not pack up during the elections. And then
maybe just a little bit of some sort of information if you had that. It may not be part of this annual report thing, because it may have been the one of the latest developments after we have made notes around March. And also just to give us a small indication whether you are enjoying anything from the demarcation board in terms of your preparations, just for information purposes, as far as you know up to now, because we may meet you quite a little bit later. I think those are the few things that I would just like to forcefully extract from you. Yes, and then in a sotirach way. You may proceed if you are ready.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. We've got a hierarchy of responding to questions. Normally in terms of this hierarchy is that I deal with the simplest, the commissioners who are with me deal with the complex, and the CEO deals with the most difficult. But now all of them are so difficult, I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure where I should start. Let me try to deal with those that I can be able to deal with very quickly. In relation to MDB, we're having constant discussions with them. The last time was about 2 weeks ago when we had discussions with the chairperson of the demarcation board. We actually requested her to come and brief us at the meeting. And we also agreed that on a weekly basis she will be briefing us about the development in relation to issues that were still outstanding. But thus far, everything seems to be on track. So we will be monitoring the situation until such time that the final handover is done. If there is an issue that will concern us, we will definitely raise that issue on time. But we are satisfied with the effort that the demarcation board has put in place in order to deal with the outstanding issues. And in relation to the ZIP-ZIPs, I can assure the committee that the ZIP-ZIPs that we have will be able to help us to go through the elections. The arrangement that we have made is that we will replenish them after the elections. So it is largely the matter of upgrading the software and making sure that it is in line with the things that we want to achieve with the ZIP-ZIP. But be rest assured, the system that we have will be able to carry us through the next elections. There was an issue that was raised, which was the first one, relating to staff not paid. This indeed had been an issue. We tried to deal with this issue, and these are the reasons why some of the staff members were not paid. You'll find that on the day of the elections, people that we had actually recruited to come in and do the work at the voting station level do not turn up within a very short space of time. You've got to recruit new people. And the details that you get from them are different. So it becomes important to try to verify. Sometimes the banking details are wrong. Sometimes they don't have banking details. You've got to also verify whether the person has actually worked or not worked. So it takes time sometimes to be able to verify those things. So it was an issue of verification that led to a situation where some of the people were not paid on time. I wanted to deal with this one very quickly so that we don't spend too much time on it. The most difficult relate to the procurement of the Riverside Office Park. This, as you all know, is a matter that emerged from the Public Protector's Report. It's a matter that was not investigated by the Commission. It's a matter that was investigated by the Public Protector. And we therefore had to implement all the remedial actions as contained within the Public Protector's Report. We've dealt with all the issues in the Public Protector's Report. The only remaining two issues relate to the disciplinary processes as well as the Riverside Office Park. members are correct, we have given this information before, that in relation to the Riverside Office Park, the matter was taken to the High Court, and in terms of the prayer of our commission is that if the Riverside Office Park has been is set aside, then we should be given an opportunity to make arrangements to find alternative office space, or to negotiate with them for the lowering of the lease, so that it is in line with the market value. You recall that in both the public protector's report as well as within the PwC forensic, it was found that we are not paying value for money. In fact, we are paying more than we're supposed to be paying. So it is those things that we are trying to finalize through the courts. Then it would be easier for us then to begin to negotiate our way out. But it is the only way, unfortunately. We could not enter into any private arrangement. We looked at this legally, and the legal opinion is that this is the route that we have to go through. What are the kind of the things that we've put in place in order to deal with this? We've had discussions with the risk committee, the chairperson of the risk committee, to say that you should actually put in place this as a risk and try to see what kind of mechanism have got to be put in place in order to ameliorate the risk. So it's a matter that is being attended to. But just to indicate to honorable members, you recall, and I'm sure you know from your own experiences, and I don't want to underplay this. Of course, if anything were to happen to us in relation to office space, it would be an inconvenience for the organization. But it does not mean that the elections will not actually take place. We have had a situation previously, in fact, almost all the elections that we've had, we relocate from our offices and we go to our results operations center in Swansea. So as one of the things that could actually be considered by the risk committee is to look into those kind of things. We run the elections from the operations center in Swansea most of the time, in fact, all the time. So it does not mean that the organization is going to be now completely disorganized to the extent that it cannot actually be able to run its operations. But it will be an inconvenience for the organization if we were to reach a situation where we are told to leave the offices immediately just because we are implementing what the court found to be unprocedural. And we do not, unfortunately, have any other option but to do what the courts have said we should do. That's in relation to the Riverside Office Park. It's a very painful and difficult situation for all of us. Just dealing with the public protector's findings on our procurement of Office Park has not been easy for us as the leadership of the organization. We've tried to move as sensitively as possible to deal with all issues related to that. But it has always been a very sensitive and difficult and complex issue. The last issue that I want to comment on, and I will check with my colleagues if they want to comment on, is related to the voter registration processes. We are indeed looking at alternative registration methods, and we're trying to find out which one would actually be the best. As soon as we have finalized the study, we will be able to share with the political parties. If it requires changes in the legislation, we will come, obviously, through the portfolio committee to Parliament to say, this is how we believe the matter can be dealt with. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to add to the last comment that the Vice Chairperson has made, that looking at other means of registration, making registration easier, I mean, including the study that you have done of the UK model, where registration is online fully. But I'm honored just to qualify that we are looking at other means of registration to make registration easier and accessible in order to deal with voter apathy. But we are not doing it for the coming election. It's too late for us to change it for local government election next year. We are looking into the future. But for local government next year, it's fixed. We are going to have 2 weekends of registration.
Is there any negotiation that the IEC is having with the Department of Basic Education where the learners, before they even finish matric or whatever, then they should be knowing about their rights to vote or not to vote? Because like as I think it is Maxson who said so, that it's only the IEC that has been established to support democracy, not the political parties. The political parties have got their own different interests. They just want these people to vote for them. But I mean, it's the question of democracy in relation to the elections and the rest. I think it is expected from the IEC to contribute in supporting this democracy. And then, is there anything, I'll just give you an example, but I mean, for practically to make sure that those that reach the age of 18 or whatever should be aware and having the correct consciousness about the meaning and the impact of a vote. I think you can proceed in your order, because you said you've got an order of responding to questions sent.
Thank you very much. Just to deal with that very quickly, we have a program, a very comprehensive program with the Department of Basic Education. We call it the Democracy, School Democracy Week, where we go through different schools, try to not only teach but impart information on democracy related issues. But we've got a program related to it, and perhaps the CEO can deal with other issues.
Okay. Thank you very much. There have been just with really, I think there are three that I'm just going to deal with. The first one is on the registration gap. It has been indicated that we are doing a study, but there have already been practical things that we have done. This committee will remember, will recall, in fact, that before the elections last year, we extended registration opportunities to South African citizens who are not in the Republic. Those opportunities exist permanently. At every one of our missions abroad, voters can approach the mission and register, even if they're there, on a short, like study and so on and so forth. The second issue is that we have, in consultation with the TLC, discussed extensively a provision that exists today, that how that provision could also be extended to voters. Like special votes, we do have home visits for registration for those voters that cannot bring themselves to the voting stations. And so, that's the opportunity that exists. The third one, it's work that we do very extensively before every election. We commission the Human Sciences Research Council to look at the attitudes and the views of voters, primarily those that are not registered, what their issues are, and we anticipate those before registration weekends or before the elections to see how best we need those. We do that study every time, and we have just gotten that result, and we factor it in the preparations for the elections as we have. And the last one is the schools. Voter Democracy Week that we have. We are talking to the Department of Education. We do believe that we can extend it beyond just a week. And part of that is to teach about why, not just how to vote, but why do we need to vote, what is necessary for someone to register and vote. And we give the learners the opportunity whilst we are there
to bring their books, their ID books, and register. The next question that I thought we needed to deal with, and Fiona, you will help me as may be necessary, make any reference to page 16 of the Auditor General's report. I was going to have a quiet question with the Auditor General on one matter that I thought we should clarify. In terms of the yellow areas on the bottom of page 6, the one that I needed to check with the Auditor General is IT systems controls. I thought every one of those was green, but I don't know, because both IT governance and IT systems controls. Perhaps you will remind me what I missed. But in the other areas, the issues are very crisp. In fact, in risk management, it is an area where we have been battling quite a little bit. We have said that to the committee before. We have put interim measures in place, but in the intervening period, there have been disruptions to those measures. We are taking care of those. The issues relating to reporting, I think my colleague Fiona has spoken to those. I leave it to Fiona to deal with in her presentation. The issues with respect to reporting as well, processing and reconciliation, I think those are the issues that she has dealt with and issues that are receiving attention. HR management was two issues. One was an HR plan that we now have in place, but by the time that the audit was completed, was in draft format and not approved. And that we have now done. We hope that when the Auditor General comes, in fact, they knew, they said you did it after and picked that up. Fiona, the others that I didn't deal with in respect to the Auditor General's report.
Thank you, Fiona. Sorry, just a point of correction. In fact, the HR plan was approved in March of 2015, but because it wasn't in place for the full financial year, but it is now in place for the full financial year that we are currently in. In relation to proper record keeping processing and reconciliations and reporting, essentially these issues revolve mainly around the heat of battle. In relation to the number of electoral staff, we appoint and pay. There's the 218,000 voting station staff, but in addition there's 4,500 area managers, 300 or so additional staff at local offices and provincial offices and municipal outreach coordinators, democracy education facilitators and so forth. And essentially it's the ensuring that we manage to develop filing systems to provide the information to the Auditor General when they select on a sample basis. The committee may recall, in fact, that the payment of electoral staff was something that we were qualified on in the 2012-2011 financial statements. And as a consequence, we have made significant steps here. But when you're talking about employing that number of staff for essentially 3 days, I think a position where every single piece of paper is always going to be instantly obtainable is not necessarily an achievable goal, or certainly not an achievable goal within the boundaries of cost effectiveness. In relation to that, in what we have discovered is that for every one piece of paper that we cannot identify in relation to a payment, it translates in the Auditor General's terms to R1 million worth of extrapolated error. Because when you're talking about a population in the tune of 218,000 and you've got a sample size in the hundreds, the smallest error when extrapolated over that population is 244 million, makes a very big difference. And as a consequence, to avoid qualification, we amended in the financial statements in this year a 2.2 million rand difference in contingent liabilities to bring the extrapolated, the total quantum of the error below the qualification threshold.
Yeah, I just did not hear properly. I think that there was one area which you were querying with the Auditor General. If that is correct, my intention is not for you to get in to get a dialogue on that one. It only forms the subject of your discussion in your office or in his office, and resolve it. And then we'll see the next report that you have resolved that matter between you two. Any further responses?
Finishing, Lamson.
The issue on pension lump sum, the Auditor General raised, I guess this was the last item that they raised. There were one or two items that they raised right at the end, and we did not have enough opportunity or enough time before the conclusion of the financial statement, the signing of a financial statement, to deal with those. It relates to what we understand to be powers that members of the Commission have and how they exercise those powers. And over the years, this has not been an issue. At the time that it was raised, we did not have the opportunity to finalize those. And we also did not have the opportunity to say to the Auditor General, can we defer this to the following year? Because they were saying, if you don't, we will qualify because we have raised this matter. And we said, we will accept it in this year, but we need to investigate it. And the agreement is, if our understanding is correct, they will reverse it. But if our understanding is wrong, we'll fix it and in the next financial period it will fall off. And I imagine that's the understanding we have with the Auditor General. Thank you very much.
Okay. Is there any other follow-up question? None. Honorable Kenny. What's that? Can you repeat it?
A misstatement which was corrected. Just to unpack.
Did you say it again, Fiona?
Lower
Tenant?
Yeah.
Let me try to deal with the Lower Tenant first before Fiona deals with it. We've got a very comprehensive communication program that we've put in place, which we're going to be launching quite soon, in order to try to get as many people as possible to participate both in registration as well as in the elections. But we always emphasize also that the political parties have got a major responsibility as our partners to excite people to make sure that they participate in the elections.
Mm-hmm. All right.
No, Chair. I'm satisfied about the answer, and I want to assure the IEC that EFF is here to make that one.
You see, that is the problem now. The IEC must decide people.
Thank you, Chair. As I indicated, we were approaching too close to qualification level for comfort in relation to the differences on electoral self-payment. And as a consequence, we made a 2.2 million rand amendment to the contingent liabilities, which was an item that the Auditor General indicated that they did not think should be there. We had included it in relation to prudence, but we removed it on receipt of the finding.
Okay, Honorable
Hussein. I just wanted to make a comment and perhaps invite the Vice Chair to respond if you choose to. But to say this, that we often take for granted the independent electoral commission in our country, and one must reflect on the importance of the role that they play. I mean, if the IEC fails, this entire country fails, and that's why I wanted to. From my side, to express our appreciation, to say, and I know the IEC tries extremely hard to keep things going and do whatever you do, and I think South Africa in general has a great respect for the IEC. But on the same token, I must also say that I have become particularly concerned over the last few months or so And the feeling that I get from people on the ground is becoming more a sense of concern about the IEC as well. I mean, we've gone through a very difficult period with the Riverside Office Park and the allegations of corruption. Opposition political parties have made their comments known about the appointment of Mr. Mashinini and all of those details. And that's becoming a great concern. And we worry about the trajectory. And, you know, political parties are by nature very suspicious characters. And the trust element is something for us that's very important. And often that perception might not be the reality, but perception is what drives the political landscape very often. And those are the things that actually create danger, as you have seen in many elections in Africa. Because of perceptions, things fall apart. So I'd like to invite your response and to hear from you, the Vice Chair. What is it that the IEC is going to do to try and regain some of the lost trust that South Africans might have had in the IEC given the last, given the turbulent times that you've been through over the last few months?
It's a very difficult question. But nevertheless, let me try to respond this way. Internally within the organization, we've got to keep on emphasizing to each and every staff member the importance of impartiality, importance of having to keep to the legal framework to do things according to what is required in terms of the law. So we've got the responsibility firstly in terms of our own organization and the people who work for the organization. So we try to do every little thing to make sure that the people that we appoint in all different areas are people who understand their responsibility and the importance of having to be impartial. And this is something that we've been emphasizing. We're emphasizing it also in training programs so that we do not encounter any little error. Because unfortunately in the electoral process, and we understand that there will be errors here and there, but we cannot afford as an organization to have widespread irregularities and errors, particularly from the side of our organization. The second aspect relates to the role of the political parties. The political parties have got a major responsibility in terms of protecting the integrity and the image of our organization. We've got the party liaison committee structures at all levels where we're interacting with the political parties, and we're hoping that if a political party is dissatisfied with any aspects of our organization, they must be able to come and raise those issues through the interactions that we have with the political parties. But in addition to that, we also visit the political parties. We've got bilateral discussions and arrangement with all the political parties, especially ahead of every election. If a political party realizes there is a particular issue of concern, they've got to raise those issues. But now, sometimes what tends to happen is that, and I've said this before, to say, you know, political leaders must be circumspect about the things that they say about our organization, particularly when they know themselves that there is no evidence of the things that they say about our organization, because it contributes in terms of tarnishing the image of our organization. And unfortunately, we can't do anything about it. We don't fight with the political parties in the media. We prefer to have a conversation with the political parties because we've got appropriate forums through which we can interact with the political party. So our approach as the Electoral Commission has always been, don't fight with the political parties in the media. Approach the political parties, have discussions with the political parties, and see how you can deal with the issues that the political parties are raising. And we have in the past been able to deal with those issues that have been raised by the political parties. If you look, for instance, the criteria that we're using to appoint the presiding officers and their deputies, it is a criteria that was agreed to by the political parties. We went office to office of all the political parties to say, how do you think we should actually deal with the issues of trust at the local level? And we then developed the current criteria that we are using to recruit the electoral staff. But the third element, and it's an element that is of great concern to us, is that recently we have noticed that quite a number of very senior journalists have been saying things that are unsubstantiated I was briefing my colleagues that I had to sit down with one of them and to say, all these things that we have actually put on paper, you know they are not true. Here is the evidence. You never even asked us for information, but you have given this as though these are facts. And people believe what you write. Because then what people do, they take the first information that they get from a newspaper, and they move around, they say, this evidence that the IEC is impartial, but we never had a platform. I mean, it's partial. And we never had a platform to deal with that particular issue. I mean, one of the simple issues that I really, really was distraught by. When a very senior journalist says the results of Pegasus could not have been a correct reflection of the people without proving, showing evidence. And I say, we've got processes in our organization where objections are dealt with, particularly those material to the outcome of the election. How is it possible that in the list of the objections, what you are saying as a statement of fact has not been raised by even a single political party? Because if a political party has lost an election and lost election unfairly, surely they would raise that issue and the Electoral Commission would actually deal with it. Now, we all have got information of all the objections that have been raised to the IEC during the elections, and this beggars that story. It's just in the paper as well as a statement of fact. Where does it come from? We don't understand. There is also an issue which people sometimes say it very loosely, that the elections in Gauteng were rigged. And we say to people, give us evidence of the things that we are saying. How come, even in the objections that we have, we don't have an objection from a political party saying the elections in Gauteng were rigged? But if indeed they were rigged, political parties participating in the elections, would they just relax and accept the results? They would not have accepted the results, because they would have been able to come to the IEC with information that would be able to indicate that these elections were rigged and this is the evidence we have. So some of our journalists don't understand, and I think we're going to have to do what we did previously, which is to sit with the leadership of various newspapers, various radio stations, brief all of them individually about what is actually happening in the electoral process. Some people don't even understand what is happening in the electoral process. There are statements that we made where a person says, we need now to have locks for the ballot boxes. They don't even know that the ballot boxes don't actually leave the voting station until counting has happened. So how can a senior journalist write those things without asking what actually happens at the voting station? But it's our responsibility as well to begin to teach people more and more about what is actually happening in the electoral process. The more they know, based on evidence of the past, the more they are able to report objectively about the electoral process. So it's an enormous responsibility, but it's a responsibility that requires all of us to create trust in the election management body. It requires the political parties, it requires media, it requires us, making sure that we stick to the law. And I think those are the minimum issues I can put on the table to try to say, this is how we can try to restore the trust. But it has especially recently been an issue of great concern to the Commission.
I think you have been bold enough to even say political statements, which I did not expect you to say them. And because you can't instruct the political parties. But definitely it is up to political parties to understand their place . We can't stand in public reducing the importance of policemen and women, and then the general public understand our blame and start undermining the policemen and women. and even kill them. And then we turn around again and say there is something wrong about the police killing. Minister, we must hear, what is your plan? But whereas we have made the fire. So it's exactly the same as well with the IEC. The IEC, I think, is the one that has got a lot of institutional arrangements, electoral court itself and all these things, and then gatherings of political parties that are involved to communicate and discuss and all that. But unfortunately, of course, is that those statements have happened where we as political parties or members of political parties, we have thrown stones at the IEC. And by doing that, of course, we have sown seeds of lowering the integrity of IEC for ordinary people now not to take the IEC seriously. And definitely it is correct. I mean, if people don't respect the IEC, then the level of integrity of the outcomes, people cannot believe in them. It is up to ourselves as political parties then to make sure that the IEC is protected and whatever, and all other challenges, people must document through the relevant forums, engage IEC, let them answer and respond on the questions, and I think that is the best route. That's the best route. Because if the IEC has lost integrity, it is not going to be to anybody's interest. It's not going to be to anybody's interest, and that would be bad. That's why we are just simply speaking with them in the room here to say, you are established to support the democracy. Do everything in your power to support the democracy. And then, but we have got a duty as well to ensure that you are protected, so that whatever outcomes that you declare through the process that we know that we have been informed, the general public should be able to accept them. The general public, you know, you can imagine if any political party, the president of any political party, stand up and say, I don't accept the results, then the support of that political party then will be up in arms as well. Because now it's a command that don't accept these results. And then we'll be creating chaos ourselves unnecessarily. And I'm sure that is fine. And it is up to us.
Yeah.
It is up to us to make sure that the IEC is protected.
Mm-hmm.
But also it is up to us to engage the IEC in the relevant forums and tell them what they must be told.
Mm.
You know, if they make mistakes, then they must be told in the correct forums, in the closed doors, and then we see the outcomes of that, and I think that would be okay. Okay. How you gonna tell you something? Okay, speak.
Okay, Chairperson, I don't want to change this making a political debate, because that will make us to lose the focus. Because now we're trying to do that. For example, that you know that democracy, there are principles in democracy that talks to majority, decision prevails. Now the reason I'm saying that is the mentioning of Mr. Masinini's name, which Mr. Masinini was a decision taken by Parliament also. We discussed the issue, but we are not going to get to discuss that issue. Welcome Mr. Masinini to us.
Secondly,
I left that political path because really we are welcoming you here. Because really it is. I don't want to say it. Then, Mr. Besson, let me go to my to my follow-up question. That's what I wanted. I don't want to discuss this issue of politics. You said you have got two options on the issue of the Riverside Office Park. Option number one is to move out of the space and find another space. And now option two, you talked about the issue of reduction on the lease agreement. Now, my question would be just simple to ask, if you think of the reduction of this lease agreement, can't we negotiate, can't you make any negotiations for the exemption from Treasury so that when you go to the reduction, you really try to go to start on a clean slate without the other expenses which are just in front of you, so that now this doesn't happen again in the same case. I mean that if you really happen to win the issue of reduction now, but there is no further irregular expenditure. Thank you, Mr. President.
Can you take it again?
I think we indicated this previously, that the issue of the irregular expenditure related to this will continue with us until the end of the lease, unless something happens similar to the one that we've already started. And unfortunately, as I've indicated, the advice we have received is that in a situation where a finding has been made that the provision of an act has been violated, you can't negotiate that. So you've got to let it go through the normal court processes. If it was possible, we've looked at all the options amongst ourselves to say, what if we do this, what if we do this? And the only option is that let there be a court statement, and then after that, you can deal with all other issues at a later stage.
Okay. No, thanks. It looks like you want to say something. Maxen.
No, Chair.
You have an opportunity there.
No, I was attempted, but I think for sake of peace and for sake of time, let us not say something. Let me not say something. But with the lighter note.
I hope that you'll do so, because that's why even myself, I did take note of Honorable Hussein's mentioning of machining, and I had serious reservations.
I must not have reason.
So that's why, but I tried to keep quiet about it.
You want me to speak in the corridor?
No.
Chair. Chair, I'm still in the platform.
But you relinquished it.
Chair.
You did say you were tempted, but you are no longer going to do that.
And I even said on a lighter note.
And then I was saying that let us do so. Even myself, I had a problem with that mentioning, because you see, the problem is that.
Just a second.
And of course, what I can say is, Deputy Chair, is that you are still on course, and then I think you have the capacity to deal with your challenges, and you should do so. And also make a call that continue, try by all means that the Commission as well as its administration cooperate, work together as an oiled machine, and then try by all means to educate the electorate, inform all parties that are that have got interest in the elections, like in the media, and then like the youth that are coming in to vote for the first time. Find a way of actually informing them, briefing them, improve your technology. You know, it's as time goes on, and then some of the technologies, then they really get out of time, and then also improve your security and logistics in relation to elections and any other related work, and then try by all means that you deliver credible elections all the time. Thank you very much for your presentation and the report. Then this meeting then is adjourned. Thank you very much.
No more. Okay.
But I'll keep it and then I'll give both. I don't mean that I've not yet, but I'll give it to
you.
But how will I remember that it's for me?
You work with media,
into impartial bodies.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. And what At one time they would find themselves in a position where they have to take a decision and the decision must impact on family. And if they read that particular point, they're not going to take a decision that would favor him.
He's
calling an uncle.
Can you make friends with him after that? I think it works.
No, it goes well. You can't go to public and then you rubbish up the person's name. And then you go there and then you start looking at it. That's nothing like that.
Yeah, but that's also the way that the Mathieu responded to the issue. It's very good.
Yeah, but the problem is he's starting even getting political.
As well, yeah.
You see, yeah. Because if he had a rogue member there, yeah, then they would have told him that there's a little bit of shit.
Yeah.
You see? Because I thought that, you know, it's, when you see this, that's what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
To throw the ball back to them. Okay. All right.
You probably won't be. You are the one. There's no.